Accession number 29238, Reel 3.
Mr. Wigan, Reel 3. You were just saying there that your father offered to get you out at one stage.
He did, yes. He could have recalled me to the family firm, being an engineering firm, of course. There were lads there were exempt, you know. But I said to him, no thanks, Dan. He said, I appreciate it, and thanks for the offer. But I said, I joined up, I volunteered to do it, and I said, I'll see it through.
Was there an anticipation that the war would last long?
Well, we hadn't a clue, really. People had talked about the First World War being over by Christmas, so I don't think anybody was as daft as that, the Second World War. But we couldn't see it finishing fast, really, you know, when you considered how far behind we were, the Germans, of armaments, etc. That you felt that, you know, you were going to be in it for quite a bit. But no, right, I thanked him, but turned it down. And I think he was actually pleased that I did. I think he'd felt it his duty as my father, since he was in the position to do so, to give me the chance. But I think without being critical, he would have been damn disappointed if, having volunteered, I backed out when the balloon went up, you know. That I think he was quietly pleased that I said no thanks, because he never pressed it again. Never.
Was there a feeling that you were going off to fight for king and country, and was there much patriotism?
Oh, there was quite a lot of patriotism then. That I don't know. I mean, when I say I don't know that the king and country came into it so much, that's not being anti-royal. I mean, the royal family were popular, that. But you thought more of your country and your family, really. You know, you didn't want some dirty great German landing in the backyard when your mother was about doing the washing and things. And that.
Was that a perceived danger that the Germans would come?
Oh, I had a parachute, you know. Yes. The first alarm that our regiment got, and it's funny in a way, we were at the Green Drill Hall, not terribly long after the war, after the start of the war, not big war, and there was an air raid warning. And I don't know whether the reconnaissance plane, certainly there was nothing dropped. But something came over, and the attack opened out over Hendon Way. And there was an immediate call for 25 volunteers. You know, 25 lads hurried forward with your rifles. And they were dished out with 5 rounds of ammunition each to go and take on all these German parachutists who were coming down. Well, it transpired, of course, that what was happening, I mean, folks were looking for it, though, and people had picked up the ACAC bursts in the searchlights and thought of parachutists, you know. But here, our 25, I didn't get amongst them. I wasn't quick enough. Were sent off with 5 rounds of ammunition each. Just take a look. I hadn't any stuff, you know. That at the time of Dunkirk, we were still in Sunderland. We were, 9 months in Sunderland, down on the seafront by then. Dykels Road Drill Hall and Seaburn Concert Hall and Seaburn Camp. And we We were spread out along the coast for coastal defence, you know, in case of Dunkirk, in case of attack. And there was the old pier at Sunderland. I don't know whether you ever knew it or not. There were the two big ones. There was the old original North Pier, which stuck out a bit. It had a little lighthouse on the end and a pathway around it. And I and a sergeant, I was a bombardier by then, I and a sergeant and a lieutenant, I think it was 9 men, were sent down there to stop the German army coming in through the piers and back in Sunderland, you see? That little up there where we sat for two beautiful summer nights, 1940. It was really a pleasure to be down, to be perfectly honest with you. And at the what we're getting round to is at the landward end of the new pier, the North Pier, there was a friend of mine, Tommy Denton, late Tommy Denton, sadly, who was a sergeant, and some lads with a Lewis gun. And during the air raid warning, because there was a convoy lying off, forming up, I remember one ship, one of them was called the Day Dawn, the biggest ship, and a flight of German bombers came in, but a convoy put up such a blooming barrage that they just said, no, we don't want this lot, and they turned around and went home. But one, I don't know whether it was from that lot of them, he did a sneak run in, you know. He came belting in low, across the piers, and Tommy up with the Lewis gun and blast off at him as hard as he could. And there were questions from regimental quarters. Who gave orders to fire that gun? Damn it, you can't say to a German pilot, please stop and let your orders to have a go at you, you know. But that was the state where, you know, ammunition that was so tight. It was ridiculous, really. When you think of the state, we used to stand guard in front of the Seaburn Concert Hall in Dykeland Road with a rifle and bayonet and no ammunition at all. And the girls walking up and down some evenings called us, no, you haven't got any ammunition.
So what happened after you described going off to camp and war being declared? Mm-hmm. What happened after that, in the days after that?
Well, as I say, we were 9 months in Sunderland, continuing training, you know, getting bits and pieces coming in, but no more guns.
Were you still at home?
No, we were billeted as a regiment in Dykeland's Road. That was the regimental headquarters. We were still field regiment then, so we were split into 294 battery and 295 battery, and 294, which was mine, we were billeted in Seaburn, the old Seaburn Concert Hall, and 295 were at Seaburn School Camp further along. So that we were together,
so you take them from there straight into
as a regiment, you see.
Can you describe your bullets? What were they like?
Well, the concert hall, of course, was a dance hall. You know, and we were just in bed spaces. You had your palias and your kit. Each man had a space on the floor. You were all laid out on the floor. Much the same, I think, down at Seaburn Camp. And there was the big dining hall of Seaburn Camp, and we all fed along there. The officers were all at regimental headquarters in Dykeland's Road, because it had been built not long before the war as a brand new territorial headquarters, you know. It's still standing, of course. ambulance, have it, a field ambulance unit have it now, I believe. But, and we were there until after Dunkirk. And just while we were there and guarding the river, etc., supposedly, that we were changed to the 125th anti-tank. And then we became four batteries, the smaller batteries. So mine 294 was split up into A and C battery, and 295 became B and D battery, and I was in A battery. 917866, Bombardier Wiggum A battery.
So what sort of things were you doing in this period? What was your daily routine like?
Well, I mean, as I say, we were training still as field artillery at Sunderland, and we used to go out on what they called TUTs, tactical exercises without troops. Yeah, and we used to go along to Whitburn Golf Course, and somebody would have a card hung around his neck, number one gun. Somebody else would have a card hung around his neck, calling himself a wagon or something, whatever it was, you know. And you did your normal drill for taking up positions with a gun, in action, you know, coming to a gun sight and taking up the positions and all the rest of it. You didn't have to go bang, fortunately. But, you know, that sort of thing, and then again, marching drill and other drills. And but, as I say, we were getting bits of equipment, small arms equipment and stuff in by then, and learning that.
What about uniform?
We're still battle dressed, you see. But we were getting some better transport, because the transport we had at the outbreak of war, there was a company in York called the Artillery Transport Company of York, and they hired out wagons and things to territorial regiments for camps. As you can imagine, I mean, they couldn't fully equip every territorial regiment with all the transport they wanted and all the rest of it. So we used to hire them from the artillery. Well, we got these carriers, blooming great big boots they were, gun towers and one thing and another. And so we had no transport of our own, so they were requisitioned at the outbreak of war. And Father came down to the drill hall one day just to have a look at us all drilling out of interest, because he never lost his interest in the forces, and Dad. And when I went home that evening, because I was near enough, you know, when you're off duty to go home, he said to me, "Lord, lad," he said, "those wagons you've got," he said, "are the same as I took to France in 1915. He said, "I took carriers just like that to France in 1915. And, you know, so that's what we started the war with. It's incredible when you think of it. But we just didn't have the stuff. Full stop. It must have been frustrating for the likes of Colonel Dean and the senior officers trying to get a green regiment up and going and trained in a state like that. He was giving pep talks and things, of course. And that, the daftest pep talk we ever had wasn't from him, thank God. We were taken over to Fenham one night. This was after Dunkirk, when the panzers had torn all over France and chased us all over, and we'd become anti-tank artillery. And we were taken over to Fenham Barracks for a lecture. And we were lectured by some brass hats, you know, staff men with their red Tabs and me. And they told us about these cardboard German tanks. That was a rumour that started just before the war, you know, that somebody had been touring Germany and in his car and had accidentally had a collision with a German tank, and it had just been cardboard and this sort of rubbish. And they stood there after Dunkirk and told us about these cardboard German tanks. Well, you know, you felt like saying, well, what are you giving us £2 of anti-tanks for? The 303 Enfield rifle would have been quite sufficient, you know. They expected intelligent blokes to believe them. It was remarkable, really, when you think of it. Some of them were living in the past, of course, in 1914-18. There's no two ways about that. Well, I went to the OCTU for a short while, and one of our lecturers there, Colonel Kersley, he was a lovely old boy, was Colonel Kersley. He was 73, I think, and it was the bitterest winter I can ever remember, 1939. And when he came into a lecture, first thing he did was take about half a dozen overcoats off, you know, loaded with overcoats. He was most interesting to talk to listen to, and very enthusiastic. And he'd written books in the library on tactics and one thing and another, but it was all First World War trench warfare tactics that he taught us. Well, you know, they just hadn't moved on. And the Germans hadn't. That was half the trouble. Bless them. You know, they were well-meaning blokes with all the guts in the world, but they just hadn't moved on. That.
What sort of training were you doing? And you were describing some of it. What other sorts of training were you doing?
Well, once we became anti-tank, of course, we had to start to learn a totally different type of gun. And that was interesting. It was fun, was that?
Were you issued with anti-tank guns straight away?
We got one or two to each battery.
What kind of gun were they?
The 2-pounder anti-tank. And they were a beautiful little gun, really were. You know, the kind you could lift them up, take the wheels off, spread legs out, take the wheels off, drop them with the three legs and have 360-degree traverse, and put the wheels on, hook them onto the wagon and away. And so we had to learn all that. And we were down in Norwich, and there was a regiment, the 21st Anti-Tank Regular Army. They'd got out of Dunkirk, and they were encamped on down the coast at Wyburn. And in batches we used to go down every day, down to Wyburn, and they used to train us on their guns that they had. And then, of course, when we got our own, we trained regularly on them. And so that we had a full complement of guns, and we were proficient on handling them, but we never got a chance.
What form did the training take?
Well, just simulated action positions, you know, getting your gun into action as fast as you could. Choosing a good sight for the gun, a sight with good forward visibility, but not stick it up like a sore thumb for the enemy, and then camouflaging it, of course, because that was the thing. In fact, one of our first instructions we got was, you know, that the front of the armoured front of the tanks were far too well armoured for these guns to pierce, So the drill was to let the tank get past you and hit him in the backside, because that was the least armoured part of the tank. So you wanted your gun well camouflaged. And all the tactics of sighting and one thing and another. And then, of course, as we by that time we had joined, we'd left 50th Division up here, and we'd been transferred to the East Anglian 18th Division. That's why we went down to Norwich. We went to the 18th Division, as who were a territorial division training, as their anti-tank. And so once we got our guns and sort of got reasonably proficient with them, they were with their bits of stuff, the various regiments and that, we started on manoeuvres and that sort of thing. You know, that was more interesting.
When did you go down to Norwich and then become part of the
18th? That was 1940, just after Dunkirk.
So you went down from Sunderland?
From Sunderland, yes.
And whereabouts in Norwich?
We were nearly 9 months in Norwich itself, actually, my regiment. And then, of course, the 18th Division was scattered all around.
Was it a camp?
No. At first, yes, when we went down to begin with, my battery and C battery. I said, you know, that our original field battery are divided into A and C, and we always tended to work together, you know. And so A and C battery, we were under canvas in Tatton Park, the parkland of Tatton Hall at Norwich. Not Tatton Park. The name's gone. It was just over the road from Horsham's and Faith Aerodrome. Oh, Tatton Park's a big place in Cheshire that I go to with my sister and daughter and son-in-law.
Anyway, sort of accommodation was it?
Under the canvas, bell tents. And that was our summer camp. And then for winter quarters, we moved from there into a big old house called Eastwood House. And we took that over, and then of course we were in the rooms of this big house. And I'm not certain just whereabouts B and D battery were under canvas, but that's where we were at Norwich, you know.
And what was that camp like?
The under canvas, sort of Catton Hall, I said Tatton, just Catton, C-A-T-T-O-N, Catton Hall and Catton Park. And Catton Park, it was a nice campsite, you know, but a lot of trees, and we were all at the tents were pitched underneath the trees for camouflage. And the hall was away up at the top.
What were the living conditions like?
Well, you had the usual, you know, your ground sheet and your palliasse. And you were camping like Boy Scouts in a way.
What did you do for food?
We had our own field kitchens. And gradually the cooks got a little bit more adept. At first it was a bit rough. But they became reasonably adept at it, you know. And then we'd pop down to Norwich when we had an evening off and perhaps have a sort of egg and chips or something in a cafe, you know. But I never complained about the army grub. I never expected it to be the way my mother made it. And we got plenty. I was never really hungry, not until I was a prisoner of war.
How did you keep yourselves clean and tidy?
Oh, we always had ablution arrangements, had water laid on, you know, and cold, of course, no hot water, no showers. But there were always arrangements for you to go somewhere once a week to get a shower, you know, pit head baths when you appear and that sort of thing. That and the laundry was regular, you know, they collected, all the laundry was done for you, of course.
What was discipline like and inspections?
Oh, discipline was pretty tight, you know, that the officers soon learned. Some of the young ones got a little bit too enthusiastic at times at first until they started to learn a bit more. But some of the young ones weren't much older than us, really. But not many. They were all a little bit older, but do what you had. And then, of course, as well, your battery sergeant major, regimental sergeant major. Regimental sergeant major, he was a regular army man. And my battery sergeant major at Norwich. Let's see. Was it there that John Saunders? Hey, that John Saunders joined us. The battery sergeant major. Well, he was a regular. He was a great bloke, was John. And so you had to keep yourself clean and smart and tidy, and your kit tidy. I mean, it wasn't as regimental as some of the real, your regular army dues. That was one of the little problems. But sometimes, if you got a regular army bloke attached to you, NCO or something of the sort, he couldn't accept easily the fact that the territorials were very different to the regular army. We were in it to get a job done and go home. Now, fortunately, John Saunders, this regimental battery sergeant, our battery sergeant major, rather, he did adapt. He accepted the situation. He understood it very well. He was a disciplinarian, mind. Oh, yes. But he knew we weren't regular blokes as he was, etc. And he made the necessary allowances. For instance, if a lad was on charge for something, maybe nothing terribly major, you know, but he would have been up to battery office before the battery commander. And if it wasn't, as I say, too severe, John Saunders would say to him, "No, do you want to go up to office or will you take my punishment?" And the lad's always took his punishment, you know. And they were made to realise they hadn't behaved themselves, but it was always a very fair and just.
What sort of punishments?
Well, it was mainly really confined to barracks, perhaps a loss of a week's pay or something like that. It had to be very severe before you went to the glass house, you know. And we had some go to the glass house, but not many. But
how did the rest of the young men react to the army lifestyle? To all of a sudden being living together, and washing together?
It was amazing how quickly everybody fitted in, really, you know. That it was very strange for a lot of people. But, I mean, you know, the likes of myself, I always wore pyjamas at home, and I wore pyjamas in the army. And other blokes were going to bed in their short shirts and whatever they liked, you know. But it was just accepted. It was your way. And it's amazing how quickly, admittedly there were one or two who never really adapted, but by far the majority, they just did, they adapted, as I said, we were just a big family in the end. But it was an interesting life, really, in that respect.
Were you still all together? All the men who joined from Sunderland, were you still all together down in
Well, as a regiment, yes, but of course, as I say, you know, we were into four batteries, and sometimes the batteries were split a bit, and they weren't always encarisoned alongside of each other. It depended how, where accommodation was, really. As I say, B&D battery, I can't remember where they were for the summer camp in Norwich when we were in Catton Hall Park. We were as A and C battery. That you know, but they could. It all depended, as I said, on what accommodation they could get, what